and white trash talking.
Hi, I'm Doug Johnson, and I'm White Trash Talking. And today I want to talk about the recent BRICS summit that was held last week in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Participating countries included the five original members, which are Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. That spells the BRICS acronym. Plus the five newest members, which are Egypt, Ethiopia, Iran, UAE, and Indonesia. Some of the topics covered were climate and the environment, AI and technology, health and social development, peace and security, global governance reform, and trade and financial cooperation. So what I will focus on today relates to a core mission of BRICS, which is to break free from the West's unipolar dominance, to create a multipolar world by establishing an alternative means of trade, and particularly de-dollarizing, by creating a new BRICS currency. Efforts by the Global South to seek an independent path from the West go back to as early as 1955 at the Bandung Conference and the Non-Aligned Movement, headed by Indonesia, India, and Egypt, and representing 29 countries from Asia and Africa. The Non-Aligned Movement faded as the Global South was integrated into the U.S.'s global economic order and subjugated by U.S.-controlled IMF and World Bank. The financial subjugation of the Global South further impoverished the majority of the world's population while fueling the empire's rise. To better understand the injustice of the West's financial control mechanisms, I want to present an interview taken from Democracy Now! Of John Perkins, who wrote the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Here is John Perkins.
Over the past 30 to 40 years, we economic hitmen have created the largest global empire in the history of the world. And we do this, there's many ways to do it, but a typical one is that we identify a third world country that has resources which we covet. And often these days that's oil, or might be the canal in the case of Panama. In any case, we go to that third world country and we arrange a huge loan from the international lending community. Usually the World Bank leads that process. So let's say we give this third world country a loan of $1 billion. One of the conditions of that loan is that the majority of it, roughly 90%, comes back to the United States to one of our big corporations, and those corporations build in this third world country large power plants, highways, ports or industrial parks, big infrastructure projects that basically serve the very rich in those countries. The poor people in those countries and the middle class suffer. They don't benefit from these loans. They don't benefit from the projects. And in fact, often their social services have to be severely curtailed in the process of paying off the debt. Now, what also happens is that this third world country then is saddled with a huge debt that it can't possibly repay. For example, today, Ecuador's foreign debt as a result of economic hitman is equal to roughly 50% of its national budget. It cannot possibly repay this debt. This is the case with so many third world countries. So now we go back to those countries and say, look, you borrowed all this money from us, and you owe us this money. You can't repay your debts, so give our oil companies your oil at very cheap costs. And in the case of many of these countries, Ecuador is a good example here, that means destroying their rainforests, destroying their indigenous cultures, and that's what we're doing today around the world, and we've been doing it. It began shortly after the end of World War II. It's been building up over time until today, where it's really reached mammoth proportions, where we control most of the resources of the world. And I was chief economist of a big consulting firm in Boston. I had 50 people working for me, PhDs, MBAs. I was doing work that macroeconomics in college had taught me was good work to do. It's all a scam. What we have here is a world empire that's controlled by a very few men, who I call the corporatocracy. And these are the heads of the big corporations, the big banks, and government. This system is built on the assumption that leaders like Torrijos are corruptible, and they are all over the world for the most part. When one stands up to the system, as Torrijos was doing, it's not only a threat in his country like Panama that we're not going to get our way there, but it also may be seen as setting a very bad example for the rest of the world, that once one leader stands up. And at that time, there was another leader standing up, too, who was the president of Ecuador, Jaime Roldos. And they were both standing up to the U.S. government. They were both standing up to the oil companies and the economic hitmen. Both of these men were assassinated by what we call the jackals, CIA-sanctioned assassins. Just a couple of months before that, they had done the same thing to Jaime Roldos, president of Ecuador. He stood up to the U.S. oil companies. We economic hitmen couldn't get through to him, and his helicopter blew up. He was setting a precedent that the oil companies couldn't stand, because throughout the world they were exploiting all these countries, as they still are. When the economic hitmen and the jackals both fail, then the last line of defense that the United States, the empire, uses these days is the military. We send in our young men and women to die and to kill. Here we are, 5% of the world's population, reaching out like a great octopus and sucking in 25% or more of the world's resources. But it's not really 5% of the world's population, the American people. 1% of the American population owns more of the material wealth than 90% of our population. So it's that 1% that are the corporatocracy that are sucking all this in, and the rest of us are supporting it through our taxes, through our purchases, through our silence.
One could argue that countries don't have to borrow money from the IMF or the World Bank. And while that's true, you should consider that the people of the country are not the ones making the choice. Rather, it's the leaders. And these leaders may have been installed as U.S. puppets, and they're installed for the purpose of making these kinds of corrupt deals. Or it could be a leader who simply succumbs to U.S. pressure to either make the deal and become personally wealthy or die. And the country's poor people, as John Perkins points out, are the ones saddled with the debt, and who suffer austerity measures and structural adjustments that are imposed on their economy, and which divert money away from the social programs and safety nets when they default on the loans. Now I want to present Ben Norton, host of the Geopolitical Economy Report, who links the BRICS push for de-dollarization with decolonization. This is what Ben Norton says.
BRICS has become one of the main platforms pushing for global de-dollarization. In fact, at the BRICS summit, Lula, the Brazilian president, called for de-dollarization. This is what Lula said, quote, "The world needs to find a way that our trade relations don't have to pass through the dollar." At the BRICS summit, Lula even reiterated his call to create a new global currency. This is what the Brazilian president said, quote, "There are political challenges, but if we don't find a new formula, we'll end the 21st century the same way we started the 20th, and that won't benefit humanity." Another point they discussed was strengthening the contingent reserve arrangement, the CRA, which is not as well known as the BRICS Bank, the New Development Bank. So the idea behind the CRA and the NDB is that BRICS created these organizations to truly serve the needs of the global south, and they don't have conditionalities. They don't have economic and political demands, and they don't impose structural adjustment on countries that are borrowing from them, which is why they are seen as important alternatives in the global south. BRICS is not just about de-dollarization. This is about something much bigger. This is about decolonization. This is about the formerly colonized countries of the global south creating a new economic, financial, and political order in which they are equal, truly equal, and the Western imperial countries that colonize most of the world lose the exorbitant privilege they have. It's not just the exorbitant privilege of the US dollar, it's about ending neocolonialism. The non-aligned movement said, we are going to try to create a new kind of world, a multipolar world, if you will. I mean, multipolarity is a term that's now being used in the 21st century, but it's really the same mission that was being pursued by the non-aligned movement in the 20th century, because you cannot actually have democracy when the US empire controls all international organizations. They're not truly international when the US has veto power in the Security Council at the UN, in the IMF, in the World Bank, in the World Trade Organization, the U.S. empire has sabotaged all multilateralism in support of unilateralism to try to destroy the multipolar order, to reimpose an imperialist unipolar order, which is really a global dictatorship controlled by the United States and really controlled by Wall Street. This is why these kinds of meetings are so important, because these countries in the global South are coming together to create a more multipolar world, pushing for de-dollarization, pushing for true decolonization to create a democratic multipolar order and to end the neo-colonial order that we still live in today.
So since 1944, the US dollar has been the world's reserve currency, which means that international trade has been done with US dollars. This gave the U.S. what's called exorbitant privilege, as it could, unlike other countries, print more money without spiking its domestic interest rates. And I want to show you a chart that shows the effects of losing the U.S. dollar reserve currency status. So without the dollar as the reserve currency, they would have weakened U.S. leverage over the IMF and World Bank. There would be less demand for IMF loans due to alternative institutions such as the New Development Bank of BRICS. Structural adjustments would become less enforceable. There would be alternative payment systems other than SWIFT. So the U.S. could not freeze the accounts of its adversaries. And finally, the U.S. would no longer be able to keep printing currency without short-term consequences. So it could no longer finance such a massive military and would have to scale back. So it would greatly reduce the U.S.'s global dominance. And this is what is at stake between BRICS and the West. Okay, finally, I want to present the views of Michael Hudson, a professor of economics and producer of the Hudson Report of the podcast Left Out. He argues that the fight for de-dollarization is actually a fight for civilization. This is what he says.
This is a fight for civilization described as American control, the American ability to control every other country's economic surplus and send it to Wall Street and the financial sector so that the 1% can grow against the 99%. And if the 1% has to sacrifice American manufacturing, American industry, at least it'll have the military industrial complex, and it will have basically the financial support that somehow you can make even more money as an economy collapses. If you're a financier, then you can make from a growing economy. The global South countries are going to realize that they cannot survive. They cannot have any government social investment, and they can't have any alternative to austerity if they pay their dollar debts. And China and Russia and Iran and their allies can say, well, you don't have to depend on the American and European markets anymore. We'll be your market. If you don't have to pay your dollar debts, you can trade with us. Of course, you will have a balance of payments deficit with us, but we're going to have a BRICS bank that will enable to fund your balance of payments deficit. And until you have the ability to grow and create your own economic surplus so that we can all trade amongst each other's other as equals. That is, to Americans, the devil. That is hell. That is independent from Americans. So the Americans would sanction the Global South. The Global South will then say the era of colonialism is over. Just as we ended old colonialism in World War II, we're now ending America's financial colonialism that it put in place from 1945 to today. And that colonialism has achieved control over our economies just as the old European colonialism used military force. America's using financial force by de-dollarizing. We will make a whole clean slate. So what we're really seeing is civilization developing into two different kinds of logic. The logic of mutual gain and material uplifting of labor and industry. And you're having the fight against it by the United States that doesn't believe in any of this. It believes in either total control or nothing. And if it can't control the 85% of the population, at least it control its own population and the European population in something near to financial fascism. But for this to happen, China, Russia, and the other countries have to create their own institutions to coordinate this mutual trade, investment, growth, and regional planning and environmental planning. Basically, you have the ideological control of the U.S. government is an ideology of such hatred that it says America has two democratic countries as model of the democracy we want to promote. Ukraine and Israel, those are our democratic models. Well, in other words, you can't have democracy without total fascist control. That's the split that we're seeing in civilization.
The U.S. is a dying empire, desperately lashing out at countries that seek independence. China, Russia, and Iran, three principal BRIC members, are already trading for the first time in currencies other than the dollar. The foundation of U.S. empire is quickly slipping away, and it remains a question whether Trump's empty bluster or the U.S.'s outdated military can do much to stop it. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining me. Please like and subscribe, and I will see you next week. Bye.